think these people are being murdered?" Julia looked down at Mowgli, unsure if she should tell Jessie how she really felt. She didn't want to upset the girl or give her false hope, but in the spirit of being honest with each other, she knew she couldn't lie after everything she had just shared. "Yes, I do," Julia whispered into the dark. "I'm going to try my best to find out why." "I know." Leaving Jessie to go to sleep, Julia carefully opened the creaky door, making a mental note to ask Barker to take a look at the hinges. As she tiptoed back to her bedroom, she realized Barker was filling another void in her life that she didn't realize was empty. It was a void Gerard had never been able to fill. Julia crawled into bed and rested her head on the pillow. She closed her eyes, but she knew she wouldn't be able to sleep. Looking up at the dark beams in her ceiling, she decided to make use of her time. Grabbing her laptop, she opened it and started researching injectable poisons that could kill without leaving a trace. Chapter 9. Saturdays in Julia's cafe were always busy, and this one was no exception. While Julia and Jessie ran around the cafe, trying to keep on top of everything, Tommy stood by the sink, washing all of the dirty dishes and doing a good job of it. When Julia promised to pay him for his time, he insisted that the unlimited supply of cakes she'd given him throughout the day were more than enough payment. Julia still slipped £30 into his jacket pocket as a thank you. When the cafe finally closed, they ate fish and chips before driving Tommy back to Fenton. He turned down Julia's offer of another night on the couch. Once in Fenton Industrial Park, Julia set up her table once more and served doughnuts and coffee to the grateful inhabitants, some of whom she was starting to recognize. She made a promise to herself that she would keep bringing her coffee and doughnuts as long as the people were there. "Did you see Cindy anywhere?" Julia asked Tommy while packing up the table and equipment as the sun started to set on Fenton. "I wanted to make sure she was okay after yesterday." "A lot of people come and go," Tommy said as he shut Julia's car boot. "You get used to people drifting in and out as they please." Julia hummed her agreement, but Tommy's explanation didn't ease her. After seeing Pete and Cindy hand over cash in exchange for a mysterious needle the night before, she was more than a little worried about the poor woman. When she saw Pete digging around in Mac's corner, she instantly made a beeline for him, leaving Jessie with Tommy in his doorway. "What are you doing?" Julia asked Pete, as he upturned the crates, standing on Mac's broken guitar as he did so. "What's it to you, lady?" Pete snarled over his shoulder. "I'm looking for money. Mac always had some from his busking." "The poor man is in a morgue somewhere, and you're looking for his money?" Julia cried, pushing Pete out of the way to pick up the broken guitar. "Have some respect. A man has to eat. I saw you take 3 doughnuts and eat them all by yourself," Julia said as she tried her best to see if the guitar could be fixed. "I saw you and Cindy last night talking to that man." "I don't know what you're talking about, lady," Pete mumbled, rolling his eyes and pushing past Julia. Julia sighed and placed the crates back to how they had been. Sitting in Mac's seat, she looked out at the industrial park with the guitar on her lap. Inhaling the cool night air, she scanned the sea of different faces, noticing how diverse the crowd here was. Some people smiled, some people looked like they were at the end of their tether, and some didn't look like they knew where they were. She wondered if this was why Mac sat here, so he could watch the world pass him by and turn it into beautiful music. Julia ran her fingers along the loose strings. They made a pathetic sound deep within the broken guitar. Cradling it like a baby, she carried it to her car and laid it on the back seat. She didn't know what she was going to do with it, but she knew Mac's legacy deserved better than to be trampled on while people searched for his imaginary pot of gold. Julia had barely locked her car when a blood-curdling cry pierced through the noise, forcing silence to descend on the industrial park. She turned around and saw Pete stumbling out of the burnt-out shell of a building, a shaky hand over his mouth. Tommy hurried over, and Pete grabbed his shoulders as he attempted to speak. Sensing what had happened, Julia hurried over. She's dead, Pete spluttered, clinging on to Tommy as he looked at the ground, looking like he was going to vomit. Oh, my God, she's dead. Who's dead? A woman asked quietly. Who is Pete? Cindy, Julia mumbled under her breath. Cindy Gilbert, Pete echoed Julia. Tommy let go of Pete and hobbled into the building, followed by a dozen others. She pushed through the crowd to be by Tommy's side as he led on. Julia understood what she meant about the man being the leader. Tommy might feel uncomfortable with the title, but people looked to him to take charge. As they walked towards a burnt-out room, which looked as if it had once been an office, their footsteps echoing in the blackened corners, Julia gazed around the shell of the building. Huge chunks of the roof were missing, and it looked as though the rest could fall at any moment. Tommy pulled back the door with his stick, instantly turning his head away and closing his eyes. Julia stepped around him and looked inside, where Cindy was curled up like a baby on a bedding of dirty blankets. There was no way the woman was alive. Leaving Tommy to shepherd the people out of the building, Julia stood by the door and called for the police, and then for Barker. Before they got there, she crept into the room, wary not to touch anything, but wanting to absorb as much as she could before the unfortunate woman was taken away. Julia hadn't been there when the other bodies had been found, but she already knew this was different. Cindy's chin was glistening, as though she'd been sick before dying. Her arms were littered with small puncture marks, some of them looking fresher than others. A syringe lay next to her body. When the police arrived, Julia stepped to the side to let them do their job. She wasn't so quick to jump in this time. She joined Jesse and Tommy, who had met up with Barker. "Has it happened again?" Barker asked quietly, pulling Jesse into Tommy's makeshift home. "I don't think so," Julia said, careful that they weren't overheard. "She's as dead as a doornail," Tommy said. "I know, but I don't think she was murdered," Julia said with a heavy sigh as she sat next to Jesse. "It's not consistent with the others." "You're starting to sound like them," Tommy said bitterly, spitting on the ground as he watched the police officers come in and out of the building. "You saw the poor woman, Julia." "Exactly," Julia said, leaning forward and looking Tommy in the eye. "I saw her in that building, not by the fence, where the others were found. She was also a woman. If only three men had died, I might think it was more random. But four shows some kind of pattern. I think they were all killed by some kind of lethal injection. And I think Cindy was killed by injection as well. But by her own hand. I saw a needle next to her body, but no needles were found near any of the other bodies." "That could mean anything, Julia," Jesse said, shrugging and looking to Tommy for answers. "I saw something last night," Julia said heavily, looking up to Barker, who was still standing, his hands on his hips. "When we were getting into the taxi, I saw Pete and Cindy talking to a man. They handed over money, the money you gave him, Barker, and the man handed back a needle. I think that's what killed her." "Accidental overdose," Barker mumbled, almost to himself. Julia nodded, looking back to Tommy. For a moment, Tommy appeared to not be thinking at all as he stared blankly at the ground. All of a sudden, something seemed to snap in Tommy's brain, and he jumped up. Leaving behind his stick, he hobbled across the car park with speed Julia had never seen in the man. He seemed to be searching for someone, and when he found that person, he sped up even more. "You killed her!" Tommy cried, launching himself on Pete and knocking them both to the ground. You pig, you did this.
I didn't, Pete yelled as he cowered under his hands. I didn't mean to. I just left her to sleep it off. I didn't know this would happen.
This is my fault, Barker whispered to Julia. I gave him the money. It's as much my fault then, Julia whispered back. I saw it happening and I didn't stop it.
It's neither of your faults, Jessie said, sandwiching herself between them. I know these people. They would have found money somehow, Barker. Nothing you could have said would have stopped them getting a fix, Julia. I've seen this happen too many times.
I think she had three kids.
Kids? Julia asked, her stomach knotting. She told me that they were taken away from her, and that's how she ended up on the streets, Jessie said darkly. She always said she would get clean for them one day, but she wasn't strong enough.
Julia quickly wiped away the tear that escaped, not wanting Jessie to see it. She shook her hair out and ran across towards Tommy. With the help of Barker, they pulled him off Pete. He hadn't actually hurt him. He didn't seem to have it in him. The adrenaline seemed to wear off, and he would have stumbled to the ground without Julia and Barker's support. With their help, he hobbled back to his seat and collapsed. His face dropped heavily into his hands. He started to sob the tears of an exhausted man. Leaving Jessie to comfort him, Julia and Barker wandered towards the exit. They watched as the paramedics carried Cindy into the back of the ambulance, covered by a red blanket. For a second time that week, Julia watched another soul drive away from the only home they knew.
I've been researching, Julia said, digging into her pocket to pull out the web page she had printed out in the early hours of the morning. This is a list of just some of the poisons that can be injected and leave little or no trace.
Barker took the piece of paper from Julia and scanned the list. She could tell he wasn't taking it as seriously as she had hoped. This is the stuff of fiction, Julia.
No, it isn't, she said, snatching the paper back. In fact, most of this can be made so easily with stuff we all have in our cupboards. Potassium chloride, for example. It's one of the things they put in lethal injections for death sentences in America. You can make it by boiling bleach into crystals in your kitchen. It kills instantly and metabolizes so quickly it's practically untraceable. I know they can only test for specific substances if they have a suspicion. If they went in thinking these things were just accidents, they weren't going to look for any of these things. Tell me that wouldn't have happened for any other person. Barker sighed and pinched between his brows. He didn't disagree because it was obvious he knew he couldn't. He knew she could very possibly be right.
We still have no proof, Barker said. I checked. Bailey has been buried. Michael's family claimed him and cremated him, and so did Roberts. There's no evidence.
A Mac? Julia asked, pulling Barker out of the way as the police officer walked towards their cars, carrying a plastic bag containing the needle. Have they even started his autopsy yet?
I don't have clearance, Barker said firmly, obviously frustrated. This isn't my case.
You must know somebody who can help. Somebody you can tell this to.
They'll think I'm crazy, Barker cried, shaking his head heavily. I have a reputation.
And what about these people? Julia cried back, not realizing she was even shouting until she heard her voice echo back to her. You promised you'd help me.
I didn't promise, Barker said firmly, pointing his finger at Julia.
I just assumed your word was as good as a promise, Julia said, already turning away from Barker. I'm sorry I called you. She walked back to Jessie and Tommy, her frustration and anger growing with each step. Barker didn't deserve to be on the receiving end of that, but she felt desperately useless. She had no idea who could be behind these deaths, and aside from her own theories and research, she didn't have a scrap of evidence. Barker was right. If she took what she thought she knew to the police, she would be laughed out of the station quicker than she could unfold her piece of paper. Tommy jumped up and clutched his stick. He walked right past Julia and headed straight for the gate.
"What are you doing here?"
Tommy cried, his booming voice silencing the scattered mumbles. "Have you no respect? A woman has just died." Julia turned to see Carl Black, the developer, who had been sniffing around on her first visit to the industrial park. He was accompanied by two men, wearing yellow hard hats and heavy fluorescent jackets, and all three of them stood out in their well-pressed, expensive suits.
"You do realize you're trespassing, don't you?"
Carl snapped back smugly, pulling back his sleeve. "As of 15 minutes ago."
"I've already warned you,"
Tommy cried, pointing his stick in Carl's face and barely retaining his balance.
"Get out of here and leave us alone."
"I'm afraid I can't do that," Carl said, pushing past Tommy, with the two men right behind him. "I'm the new owner of your little hovel, and I'm coming to see what I've bought and what damage you people have done to it."
"Didn't you hear the man?" someone else cried. "A woman has just died." "One less of you to clear out," he cried back.
Carl marched forward undeterred, the smug smirk on his face not wavering. The two men behind him looked less sure, half running, half walking to keep up with him. She was glad when the policeman standing guard outside of the building wouldn't let Carl pass.
"That man has some cheek,"
Tommy said as he joined Julia by her side.
"Some people have no humanity left in them."
"Our days here are numbered," a woman said as she walked past.
"Where will we go?"
Julia had known this day would come eventually. A piece of land this big in such a great location wasn't going to stay vacant for much longer. She was surprised it had been up for sale for 6 months. The fire had cleansed the area, giving it a purpose in housing the homeless, but the developers were about to wipe these people away in the name of progress. It didn't feel very progressive to Julia.
"What now? Where will you go?" "We'll stay here as long as we can," Tommy said. "We're stronger together."
Julia smiled and nodded, but her disagreement was written across her face, and she knew Tommy could see it.
"You don't agree?"
he asked, almost offended.
"Maybe it's better to move on?"
Julia suggested quietly, watching as Carl and his developer friends walked around the perimeter of the industrial park, pointing things out and scribbling down notes.
"You're being targeted here. If you left, the murders might stop." "And go where?"
Tommy snapped, looking darkly down at Julia.
"The world doesn't want us. I wouldn't be surprised if Carl had paid somebody to bump us off, to scare us away. It won't work. Do you hear that, Carl? It hasn't worked. We're not going anywhere."
Carl didn't pay him any attention, so Tommy cursed under his breath and hobbled back to his spot in the doorway. He collapsed into his blanket and rested his head against the metal door, his thick lids clamping shut. Jesse appeared to be talking to him, but if he was listening, he wasn't responding.
"Are you pleased with yourself?"
Julia demanded of Carl as she marched towards him. "Men like you make me sick."
"Men like me, sweetheart?"
Carl snickered as he flicked between two pages on a clipboard. "There's nothing dirty about property, but there's something dirty about men like you not wanting to help people."
"I donate to charity,"
Carl said, laughing sourly.
"These people don't need my help, any putting down. They're human beings, you horrid man. They're a drain on society,"
Carl cried, pushing past Julia and continuing with his survey. One of the men smiled an awkward apology at Julia as he hurried past. She wondered if Carl would think that way if he spent some time here and got to know the people he was judging. Julia had learnt so much by being here, and she knew she would never look at the homeless the same again. They were all people with stories and pasts, just like any other person. Carl didn't look at them as being on his level because it seemed easier to disregard their humanity and make it easier to sweep them under the rug. After collecting Jessie and getting back into her car, they drove silently to Perrydale. She pondered on what Tommy had said about Carl wanting to scare the people away so he could get on with his development. Could money really drive a man to kill in order to get what he wanted? She didn't want to think any person could resort to such dramatic measures for something so trivial, but she remembered how he hadn't cared at all that somebody had just died. "One less of you to clear out," she whispered Carl's words under her breath as they walked through the dark towards her cottage. Chapter 10. Julia woke bright and early on Sunday morning so she could volunteer at Stella and Max's soup kitchen. She dressed in the dark, fed Mowgli, and left a note for Jessie under a London Eye magnet on the front of the fridge. As the sun started to rise in the distance, she drove down the winding lane into the heart of Perrydale, slowing as she passed Barker's cottage. The lights were turned off and the curtains were closed. She almost pulled up and knocked on the door, despite the early morning, but she stopped herself. She didn't like how they had left things at the industrial park yesterday and couldn't help but feel like she would handle the situation better after having had a good night's sleep. When she was parked, between her cafe and the post office, she let herself in via the back door and started to gather up the ingredients she would need to make a lot of chocolate chip cookies. She had decided on it last night, after flicking through her mother's old handwritten recipe books, because they were easy to make, could be easily replicated, and they always went down a treat. She had yet to meet a person who hadn't fallen in love with her rich, buttery chocolate chip cookies. Julia poked her head through the beaded curtains and stared at her immaculate cafe. She loved working there, but she was glad of her one day off a week. If she was honest with herself, she would like another day off during the week, so she could relax or go shopping. If she continued to train Jessie the way she was, she might be able to leave her on her own more often, without the immense feeling of guilt. She was about to leave the cafe when she saw a shadowy figure running across the village green through the early morning haze. Walking through her cafe and squinting through the glass, she saw her gran clutching her skirt as she ran like an athlete. Pulling her keys from her pocket, she unlocked the door as her gran approached. "Julia!" Dot cried as she breathlessly clutched her sides. "I thought you were a burglar." "In my own cafe?" "You can never be too careful. Are you opening?" "I'm just grabbing some things. I'm volunteering at a homeless soup kitchen, and I thought I'd make some of my mum's chocolate chip cookies." "The buttery ones?" Dot narrowed her eyes as she finally caught her breath. "Why do you want to go and do that for? Sounds like a waste of a Sunday, if you ask me." "Because these people need our help and support," Julia said firmly, expecting better of her gran. "What are you doing up so early, anyway?" "It's my turn to stake out the village green," Dot said, glancing over her shoulder at a fold-up chair in her garden. "Me and the girls take it in shifts." "You're taking this neighbourhood watch very seriously," Julia said through a smile. "You know you're only supposed to keep an eye out, not spy." "We're not spying. We're staking out, like in those American cop movies. It's very popular over there, you know." Julia nodded, wondering where her gran was getting her information. She had expected her neighbourhood watch obsession to have died off by now, but it was taking up most of her time. So much so that she hadn't summoned Julia and Sue to her house for dinner for over a week. "Found anything interesting yet?" "Lots," Dot said, barely containing her grin. "Did you know Mary from the hairdressers is cheating on her husband with the butcher?" "I didn't," Julia mumbled through half-closed lips. "But I do now. Be careful who you tell your information to. Supposed to be helping the village, not ripping it apart. It's all in the name of community spirit, Dot said proudly, crossing her arms under her chest. Amy Clark is going to take round a fruit basket and break the news to Mary's poor husband later today. I don't doubt he's going to be absolutely devastated, but he has a right to know. I didn't know you and Amy Clark were friends. Well, we're not really. She asked to join, and I couldn't say no, what with her being an ex-bank robber and having served hard time. That's what the Americans call prison. I thought she would be a fine addition to our group. Julia smiled, unsure of what to say. Her gran never failed to surprise her. She wondered if she had been the same way as a young woman, or if her brutal brand of honesty had come with age. If Julia had to guess, she would say her nan was born, telling things like they were. Knowing her gran was only interested in idle village gossip, Julia said her goodbyes and let her gran get back to her fold-up chair and binoculars, so she could continue scribbling down the goings-on of the unsuspecting villagers. After loading up the car, she drove to the soup kitchen, passing Fenton Industrial Park as she did, if only to make sure there wasn't another ambulance taking away another body. She wasn't sure if it was her imagination, but there seemed to be fewer people milling around than yesterday. She remembered what Tommy had said about people coming and going, but she also wondered if the recent string of deaths had succeeded in scaring people away from the now sold land. Julia knew her theory about Carl killing off the residents of Fenton Industrial Park was a stretch, but it was all she had to work with right now. Julia! Stella beamed from behind the counter as she walked in carrying her boxes of ingredients. You came. Max, go and give her a hand. After gratefully handing the heavy boxes over to Max, she joined Stella behind the counter, where she was chopping vegetables for the day's soup. Julia pitched up next to her and started to sift out her flour. Baking is a skill I always wished I had. Stella said softly when she'd finished chopping the carrots. God never bless me in that department. You make lovely scones, dear, Max said, diving in to peck her on the cheek. God blessed you in other ways. My scones are like rock cakes, Stella whispered to Julia when Max took the carrots away and dumped them in the giant vat simmering over a low heat. My husband is too kind. Baking is like driving, Julia said, as she added in the butter. Once you learn the basics, you only really start learning for real when you've passed your test. When you have the basic knowledge of why certain things work and how ingredients come together, you'll be able to venture out and start creating your own recipes. It all sounds far too complicated for me, Stella said meekly, her fingers brushing over the silver cross around her neck. I'm more suited to cutting the vegetables. Max has always been the cook. Julia smiled and nodded. She decided against replying. She wondered if Stella knew she had put herself in an outdated stereotype of what a wife should be. It didn't seem intentional, but it upset Julia all the same. She had been the same way with Gerard, but it was only when she realized she could fly on her own that she soared. Unlike Gerard, however, Max seemed like a lovely husband. Not wanting to judge how their dynamic worked, Julia turned her attention to sprinkling the chocolate chips into the dough. My mother taught me to bake, Julia said, when she had achieved the perfect chip-to-dough ratio. Without her, I doubt I would be able to make a simple sponge cake. Are you close to your mother? I was, Julia said softly, smiling through her pain. She died when I was a young girl. I still think about her every day, but I'm not sure if much of what I remember is real or things my imagination has created over time. Your mother is here with you in spirit every day, Stella said, resting her hand on Julia's and then immediately pulling it away. The dead never truly leave us. It was a theory Julia wanted so desperately to believe in. Over the years, she had felt her mother's presence, usually when she had hit rock bottom. If she felt her mother's presence when she was lying in bed at night or doing the washing up in her cafe, she might have believed it was more than her own conscience creating the feelings of closeness. Somewhere, in the back of her mind, she held on to the hope that she would see her mother again one day. "Maybe you're right," Julia said, as she chewed the inside of her cheek. "It's a nice idea, isn't it?"
"It's not an idea," Stella said,
her pale brows tilting inwards as though it was obvious.
"The Bible tells us so.
When Jesus died for our sins, he returned to his disciples and walked among them in death. I believe the spirits of our departed loved ones walk alongside us, even if we cannot see them. Those we love never truly leave us."
"Stella, can you take over stirring?" Max called across the kitchen.
Stella smiled meekly at Julia before scurrying off. Julia didn't doubt Stella believed what she was saying. She wanted to believe so desperately too, but her logical brain wouldn't let her believe that her mother was walking alongside her. She glanced awkwardly over her shoulder, wondering if her mother really was there. A cold chill brushed against her neck, making her arm hairs stand on end. It wasn't until she saw Max closing the open back door she realised how silly she was being. As she started to roll the dough into small balls, she looked over to Stella as she struggled to stir the soup with the giant wooden spoon. Julia wondered what spirit was walking alongside her. The pain hidden under Stella's conviction hadn't gone unnoticed. Reminding herself it wasn't her place to ask, she continued to roll her dough in silence. By lunchtime, the empty canteen transformed into a hub of activity. Stella and Max's soup went down a treat, as did Julia's cookies. Some of the faces she recognised from Fenton smiled at her, but most of them were different people, only confirming to her how widespread the problem was.
"Do you have a bathroom?" Julia asked Max.
"We don't have a public one, but there's one me and Stella use in the yard." Julia thanked him and pushed on the heavy metal door into the stone yard. The smell of rotten vegetables hit her immediately, radiating from the overflowing uncollected bin in the corner. Clutching her nose, she stepped over the rubbish towards the small outhouse. She opened the door and immediately closed it again when she saw Stella.
"I'm so sorry," Julia called through the door, her cheeks flushing from embarrassment. "I should have knocked."
"It's okay," Stella mumbled back as she washed her hands. Julia thought about what she'd seen in the split second she had seen Stella. She'd been sitting on the toilet, but she was hitching her blouse up, and she appeared to be injecting something into her stomach. When Stella opened the door, smiling awkwardly down at the ground, she was clutching a small needle with a blue syringe.
"I'm diabetic," Stella said before Julia asked.
"Type 1. I was diagnosed when I was 6, so it's my version of normal."
"I really should have knocked."
"I'm not ashamed of it. It's as normal as brushing my teeth or putting on shoes. God only gives his hardest battles to his strongest soldiers." With that, Stella hurried around Julia and back into the kitchen. When Julia was finished in the bathroom, she joined her behind the counter as Max started to clear away the bowls and plates from the tables that had already finished and left.
"I didn't think you used actual needles anymore for diabetes," Julia asked, trying to sound casual. "I could have sworn it was those injectable pen things."
"It is usually," Stella said.
"I've been a bit silly. I've lost my insulin pen yesterday, and I haven't had time to go to the doctors to get a replacement. I'd lose my head if it wasn't screwed on."
"It's not the first time either," Stella said as she filled up the sink with hot, soapy water.
"I lost it on holiday in the Lake District last summer. They didn't have any replacements at the pharmacy. It was a tiny village, and there weren't any diabetics, so they gave me some needles and vials of insulin so I could do it the old-fashioned way. We ended up cutting our trip short, so when I got back, I got my replacement pen. I keep the needles here as an emergency. It's not
technically allowed, but God knows I wouldn't abuse them. I would have reported the pen missing sooner, but since Fenton got so full, we've been working all hours God gives us. Report it? As in, report it to the police? There are people out there who abuse the insulin, Stella said, glancing over her shoulder and narrowing her eyes. Why do you ask?
No reason, Julia said with a smile. I'm just curious.
Stella narrowed her eyes on Julia even further, but her expression didn't shift. She busied herself with wiping down the counter, and Julia almost thought her question was going to be ignored.
So many people are scared of needles, but they have no reason to be, Stella said, as she focused on scrubbing a patch of dried-on soup. The insulin pens are a little cleaner, but I don't mind the old-fashioned way. Pain is a part of living.
I must admit, I'm not the best when I need to have an injection.
Think about Jesus's pain, hanging on the cross, Stella said firmly, as she walked over to the sink to wash the cloth. Even with nails in his hands and feet, he didn't beg for mercy like many expected him to. He knew he was dying for our sins, and he accepted that he was going to a better place, to join his true Father in heaven.
Julia was beginning to wonder if all of their conversations were going to revolve around stories from the Bible. It reminded her of being forced to sit still in church as a little girl, as the priest droned on and on in his monotonous voice about sins and scripture. She'd always wondered if she had found the church experience more fun, would her faith be stronger?
So, do you keep a lot on hand for spare? Julia asked, following Stella over to the sink, where she had already started to wash the large pile of plastic bowls and plates.
They gave me a 2-week supply that time. It was extraordinary circumstances.
It sounds like you have a lot left over.
Why are you so interested? Stella asked, stopping her scrubbing to turn and look at Julia.
Oh, my gran was recently diagnosed with diabetes, Julia lied quickly, hoping her cheeks wouldn't burn too brightly. I just wanted to get to grips with it in case she needed my help.
She'll have type 2. You don't always need to inject insulin with type 2, Stella said, returning to the dishes, Julia's lie seeming to wash over her.
Although, now that you mention it, there were less needles than I expected this morning.
Oh, the box seems a little emptier than I remembered, Stella said. It shouldn't be a problem.
In the last couple of months?
I haven't looked at them for nearly a year because I haven't needed them, Stella said, her tone growing more and more frustrated with Julia's questioning. Can you pass me that cloth?
Julia decided she had pushed her luck, so she started to gather up her leftover ingredients.
As she did, she wondered if Stella's needles had really been misplaced or if they had been stolen. She knew it was a long shot, but whoever was killing the homeless people could have stolen the needles from Stella's supply, a theory which didn't sit right with Julia. If it were true, it meant a homeless person was killing other homeless people, and that turned Julia's stomach.
When she'd packed up her things, she decided she was going to leave Stella and Max to prepare for the evening serving. Stella seemed to be offended by Julia's questioning, so she knew it was better to retreat before the tension grew. On her way out, she paused at the framed newspaper clipping of Stella, Max and their daughter. As she read through the article, Max joined her and started to read.
"Your daughter is very beautiful," Julia said.
"She was," Max said, sniffing, as he adjusted his thick-rimmed glasses. "She died, just before Christmas."
"I didn't realise," Julia mumbled, her hand drifting up to her mouth. "I'm so sorry."
"It's okay," Max said, smiling down at Julia to let her know he wasn't upset. "I'd like to say it was getting a little easier every day, but I'd be lying. I heard you talking to Stella about your mother, so I know you understand the pain."
"Like Stella said, she's here with you,
if you believe that," Max said, his eyes suddenly glazing over.
Death can send people closer to God in ways one never expected. With that, he left Julia and joined his wife in the soup kitchen. She finished reading the article before heading for the door. Before she left, she looked back at Stella and Max, who were working silently in the kitchen, not speaking to each other. Their relationship suddenly made more sense to Julia. It was almost as though she could see the strain the death of their daughter had placed on them, but she could also sense how desperately they wanted to cling to each other. It seemed as though dedicating their lives to helping the homeless was a worthy distraction for both of them. After packing her leftover ingredients and equipment in the boot of her car, she drove back to Perrydale with a heavy heart and a lot on her mind.
Chapter 11.
On Monday morning, Julia sat in her cafe like a customer, sipping peppermint and licorice tea and scribbling notes in her pad. She wrote down everything she could think of connected to the deaths, including the list of clues she had gathered and possible motives. She flipped the page and wrote "suspects" at the top in big, bold lettering. After underlining it a couple of times, she realised she didn't have a single one.
"We're running low on cupcake cases," Jessie called from the kitchen. "And icing sugar."
Julia mumbled back as she underlined the word again before flipping to her stock check ingredients list and scribbling down "cupcake cases" and "icing sugar."
"Anything else?"
"Not that I can think of," Jessie said as she walked through the beads separating the kitchen and the cafe. "I wrote down a recipe from the cookbook. I didn't know if you wanted to try it or not."
Jessie unfolded a small piece of paper and tossed it to Julia, stepping back and shrugging. Julia read over Jessie's messy handwriting, smiling as she did.
"A Chinese sticky rice cake? I thought it sounded nice," Jessie said, almost apologetically.
"It's up to you."
"It sounds great. We'll give it a shot this week."
Jessie seemed surprised and smiled awkwardly, looking down at her shoes. Julia scribbled down the ingredients before flipping back to her investigation page. She motioned for Jessie to sit across from her. Julia grabbed two giant cream and jam scones from the display case and set them on the table.
"I've been writing down everything I know about the case," Julia mumbled through a mouthful of scone as she licked cream from her lips. "It's not a lot."
"Start at the beginning," Jessie said, before cramming half of the scone straight into her mouth.
Julia sipped her peppermint and licorice tea, glancing to the door. The village green was empty, and the few villagers who were out were walking right by Julia's cafe. She didn't mind. She'd come to look forward to her quiet Mondays and was almost disappointed when she was serving more than a couple of customers at a time.
"We have four men, all dead without a real cause of death," Julia started, dusting her icing sugar-covered fingers on her dress as she licked the last of the fruity sweet jam off her lips.
"They don't seem to be connected in any way, other than that they are men, homeless, and they all died in the same place. We know at least two of them had puncture marks on their arms, but we also have testimonials from people who don't believe they would voluntarily take drugs."
"Bailey wouldn't for certain," Jessie jumped in, mumbling through her full mouth and spitting crumbs as she did. "His folks died from overdoses. He told me when we were back in the system together. He hated it.
And I spoke to Mac, and he told me he didn't touch anything, and that Robert didn't either. Pete also said Father Thind wouldn't, so that's all four men."
"Why haven't the police noticed this?"
"They're not connecting the deaths," Julia said, sighing as she rubbed her brow. "You've got cream on your chin."
Jessie quickly wiped where she was pointing and licked her finger clean. She narrowed her eyes and screwed up her face as though she was thinking hard. When she was finished, she looked sceptically down her nose at Julia.
"Why wouldn't they connect them? It's obvious." Maybe, but Barker said they probably don't want to link the deaths because if they do, they're going to be looking for a serial killer. They probably don't want to cause a panic. Instead, they're just letting them die one by one. It seems that way, Julia said, nodding as she resumed reading her notes. I've been researching different poisons that can kill people without leaving a trace, and the list seems endless. Most of them can be made quite easily, without many ingredients. It's rather worrying. Most of them wouldn't even show up, even if somebody went looking for them. And those needles that were nicked from the soup kitchen? That might not be connected, Julia said, tilting her head, although it is suspicious. It would certainly give the murderer the means to do what they're doing. And it would have to be someone who visited the soup kitchen, Jessie added. Only homeless people really know about that place. Julia flicked the page to her list of possible motives. Most of them seemed as far-fetched as the next, but they were all she could think of. Motives, Julia read aloud. Somebody is trying to scare the homeless away from Fenton. So, the developer? Perhaps, Julia agreed, flipping to the empty suspects page and scribbling down Carl Black. That's one suspect. One is all you need. He certainly seemed cold-hearted enough to do something so evil. Julia circled his name several times. Money can make people do crazy things. There are other motives, though. The other idea I had is that there is somebody with a vendetta against the homeless, so they're taking it out by murdering as many as they can. That wouldn't surprise me, Jessie said, rolling her eyes. There wasn't a day that went by that I didn't meet somebody who hated me because I was homeless. But who? The police? Jessie offered, drumming her fingers on the table. Those officers just want to get rid of us to save them the job. They can't rehouse us all. Julia reluctantly wrote down the police, even if she didn't believe that one. She knew it wasn't impossible, but she couldn't imagine an officer taking the law into their own hands in such a way. We also have another homeless person, Julia said, gauging Jessie's reaction carefully. Perhaps there was a person who was connected to all four of the men and had a different grievance with each of them. What's a grievance? It's like a problem, she said, a falling out. Jessie looked down at her drumming fingers and screwed up her face. Julia could practically hear the cogs turning in her brain. I don't think so, Jessie said, shaking her head. They're like a family. Julia clenched her jaw as she smiled. She believed that Jessie really did believe that, because it was all she had to cling on to for so long. But Julia wasn't so sure any more. The more time she spent with the people at Fenton, the more she realised they were normal people who didn't always get along, despite their similar situations. Besides, who would want to do that? Jessie asked. Pete, Julia offered. He doesn't seem to like many people, and he knows how to use needles. He even seems to know people who could supply him with deadly concoctions. But murder, that seems a stretch even for him. Perhaps, Julia agreed, writing his name down anyway. There are still so many people I haven't spoken to yet. The murderer could be hiding right under our noses. Jessie flinched uncomfortably in her seat. It was almost as though they had landed on the same name at the same time, but in very different contexts. No, Jessie cried, before Julia could even say anything. Tommy wouldn't do that. Why would he? I'm not saying he would, Julia said calmly, leaning forward and dropping her pen. He's just at the scene every time, and he found Bailey. Exactly, Jessie said, forcing a laugh. Why would he draw attention to a kid he'd just murdered? They didn't always get along, but Tommy wouldn't do that. Tommy didn't mention they didn't get along. Well, it wasn't that they didn't like each other, Jessie said quickly, stumbling over her words. Tommy just didn't like the graffiti. He didn't understand it. It was Bailey's way of expressing himself, but Tommy thought he should respect Fenton as their home while they were there. He said if we didn't respect it, people wouldn't respect us. Bailey was a good kid. I'm not saying he wasn't, Julia said, reaching out and grabbing Jesse's hand. You don't have to worry. We're only throwing ideas around. Some of them will sound silly, but it allows us to rule people out, okay?
Jesse nodded as she ferociously chewed the inside of her lip. She pulled her hand out of Julia's and fumbled with her fingers in her lap.
What was Tommy's relationship with the others? Julia asked, picking up her pen and hovering over a fresh page. Just so we can rule him out.
He liked the priest, even if he thought his preaching was a waste of time, Jesse said, as she stared blankly at the empty plate in front of her. He used to say Michael was wasting his time reading his Bible. So they weren't exactly friends.
They're not all friends, Jesse said, frowning at Julia. You can't like everybody.
Julia nodded, not wanting to contradict Jesse's statement that they were all a family who looked out for one another. She had members of her own family that she didn't particularly like, so she knew that didn't immediately make a man guilty.
What about the banker, Robert?
I don't know. They had an argument once, but that doesn't mean anything.
What did they argue about?
Robert fell asleep in Tommy's spot. He was new at Fenton's, so he didn't realise not to sleep there. It was only a small thing. They were fine afterwards.
And Mac? Julia said, barely looking up as she scribbled all of this down.
What did he think of Mac?
He liked Mac, Jesse said, almost relieved. Everybody liked Mac. Even if his guitar playing kept us awake, Tommy didn't mind too much. He told him once or twice to stop playing, but it was never anything serious.
Julia wrote down everything Jesse said, almost word for word. She wondered why Tommy hadn't told her these things before. He had acted as though he was friends with all of the victims. The more Jesse spoke, the more it sounded like he had had some kind of disagreement with each victim. As she read back her notes, she knew none of them were enough to drive a man to murder. But months had passed since Jesse had left Fenton, so plenty of murder-inducing arguments could have happened in that time. Tommy's elderly, kind face appeared in Julia's mind, and she immediately felt guilty. The man had been nothing but nice to her, and she was grateful that he had looked out for Jesse in her times of need. The guilt writhed painfully in her stomach as she added his name to her suspects list. She didn't want to believe he could be capable of such terrible things, but she didn't have enough suspects to rule anybody out.
Tommy didn't do it, Jesse muttered. He's good.
I know.
You know he didn't do it, or you know he is nice. Julia's smile wavered. She looked down at the freshly inked name on her suspects list and snapped the pad shut before Jesse could see.
Both, Julia lied as she gathered the plates and hurried off to the kitchen, before Jesse could further question her. As Julia washed up the two plates, as slowly as she could, she mulled over everything. She was so deep in thought, she didn't hear the bell above her cafe door ring out, so she jumped when she turned and saw Barker poking his head through the beads.
"Is it a bad time?" Barker asked as he walked into the kitchen.
"No, he just gave me a fright," Julia said, her hand resting on her chest.
"What can I do for you, Barker?"
He was in his usual work suit and camel-coloured trench coat, which told Julia he probably didn't have long. She doubted he was here to take her on another lunchtime picnic, especially after how they had left things on Saturday night. They both tried to speak at the same time, as they stepped closer to one another. Julia laughed and motioned for Barker to speak.
"I'm sorry about the other night," Barker said shyly, pushing back his trench coat and shoving his hands in his trouser pockets. "The stress of this whole thing was just getting to me. I worry about how deep you get into these things, and I reacted badly."
"I can't help it."
"I know," Barker said quickly, looking straight into her eyes. "It's what I love about you. You care about things more than other people do."
Hearing the word love did something unexpected to Julia's heart. It suddenly started to race, causing her to feel like she was burning up. She attempted to swallow,
but her mouth was as dry as an overbaked sponge cake.
"I'm sorry too," Julia said, her tongue feeling like it was swollen. "You're right about caring too much. It's all I can think about right now."
"For what it's worth, I think you're right," Barker said urgently, stepping forward and pulling something from his pocket. "I called in some favours and pushed them to do a full toxicology report on Mac's body."
He handed the sheet to Julia, and the plethora of information boggled her mind. She stared at the list of chemical symbols and combinations she didn't recognise. She shook her head and passed the sheet back to Barker.
"K," Barker whispered, pointing to the top symbol on the sheet.
"I'm a baker, not a scientist, Barker."
"K is the chemical symbol for potassium."
Barker folded the paper and stuffed it back in his pocket. They found a lot of it in his system, more than just a couple of bananas worth.
"Enough to kill a man?"
"That's where it gets complicated," Barker said, taking in a sharp intake of breath through his teeth. "Like you said, some of the lethal poisons metabolize and vanish, barely leaving a trace. This is what it left behind, but alone it's not enough to be ruled as a cause of death."
"But coupled with the needle marks and the others?"
"There are no others, remember," Barker interrupted, stepping closer and dropping his voice to a whisper. "The other three were all ruled as inconclusive. They were never looking for lethal poisons, or even a trace of anything. As far as they're concerned, Mac's cause of death is just as inconclusive as the others."
"Surely that's enough to suggest a pattern?"
"Only if they're being linked," Barker said, sounding almost frustrated with Julia. "Aside from their location, these men have nothing in common. They're all completely different ages with different backgrounds. You're only linking them because you've spoken to people and painted a bigger picture."
"And the police won't, because they have no reason to suspect anything."
"Exactly," Barker said, resting his hand on Julia's shoulder. "You're right about this being discrimination. If this happened in Perrydale, the frequency alone would be enough to cause suspicion.
But because the rate of death among homeless people is higher, this is being looked at as normal."
"Unfortunately, that's what's happening," Barker said, deep sadness in his voice. "I was looking into it last night, and the statistics made me feel sick. Homeless people are 20 times more likely to die just because they're homeless."
"Which means the police care 20 times less," Julia said, pushing her fingers up into her hair. "This is so frustrating."
"Not all police," Barker reassured her. "We're on the same page now. I'm seeing this through your eyes, and it's making me feel awful. I saw homeless people when I lived in the city, but I never cared. Not really. I'd give them money when I could, but I always felt so separate."
"We can help them," Julia said, grabbing both of Barker's hands. "We just have to stop this before it gets any worse."
"How do we do that?" Barker asked, clenching Julia's hands tightly. "Mac's potassium levels aren't high enough to launch an investigation. I mentioned that was happening in passing to the chief inspector, just to gauge his reaction."
"I'm guessing it wasn't a favourable one."
"He laughed and told me to spend my time looking into important things," Barker said, his deep voice with regret. "We're alone."
"When has that ever stopped me, Barker?" Julia said. "We don't need resources to figure this out. We just need to talk to people and keep digging."
"But we don't have a plan," Barker said, letting go of Julia's hands and pushing them back into his pockets. "Or any leads."
"I've got some ideas," Julia said nervously. "You're probably not going to like them, though."
Chapter 12. Julia was running down a never-ending corridor lined with doors. She knew she was dreaming, but she clutched at the door handles anyway, sure the answer to what she was looking for was behind one of them. She ran like she had never ran in her life, daring to glance over her shoulder as the corridor melted away in a pool of fire and ash.
Squinting into the dark, she saw a glimmer of light, beaming through a slit under a door at the far side of the corridor. She knew the answer to what she was looking for was behind that door. She reached out and ran, but she felt like she was walking through mud and her feet were cast in solid cement blocks. Crying out, she was surprised when no noise escaped her throat. She looked back to the door, and it was within reach. She wrapped her fingers around its metal handle.